My mother watched us from inside the house, propped up at her desk, grading papers. What are they talking about? She wondered to herself. Blood and guts, probably. Swallowing nails. Cheerful, manly things. She laughed aloud, then caught herself. That wasn't fair. She really was grateful for Lolo's solicitude toward me. He wouldn't have treated his own son very differently. She knew that she was lucky for Lolo's basic kindness. She set her papers aside and watched me do push-ups. He's growing so fast, she thought. She tried to picture herself on the day of our arrival, a mother of 24 with a child in tow, married to a man whose history, whose country, she barely knew. She had known so little then, she realized now. Her innocence carried right alongside her American passport. Things could have turned out worse. Much worse. She had expected it to be difficult, this new life of hers. Before leaving Hawaii, she had tried to learn all that she could about Indonesia, the population, fifth in the world, with hundreds of tribes and dialects, the history of colonialism, first the Dutch for over three centuries, then the Japanese during the war, seeking control over vast stores of oil, metal, and timber, the fight for independence after the war, and the emergence of a freedom fighter named Sukarno as the country's first president. Sukarno had recently been replaced, but all the reports said it was a bloodless coup, and that the people supported the change. Sukarno had grown corrupt, they said. He was a demagogue, totalitarian, too comfortable with the communists. A poor country, underdeveloped, utterly foreign, this much she had known. She was prepared for the dysentery and fevers, the cold water baths and having to squat over a hole in the ground to pee, the electricity's going out every few weeks, the heat and the endless mosquitoes. Nothing more than inconveniences, really. And she was tougher than she looked, tougher than even she had known herself to be. And anyway, that was part of what had drawn her to Lolo after Barack had left. The promise of something new and important, helping her husband rebuild a country in a charged and challenging place, beyond her parents' reach. But she wasn't prepared for the loneliness. It was constant, like a shortness of breath. There was nothing definite that she could point to, really. Lolo had welcomed her warmly and gone out of his way to make her feel at home, providing her with whatever creature comforts he could afford. His family had treated her with tact and generosity and treated her son as one of their own. Still, something had happened between her and Lolo in the year that they had been apart. In Hawaii, he had been so full of life, so eager with his plans. At night, when they were alone, he would tell her about growing up as a boy during the war, watching his father and eldest brother leave to join the Revolutionary Army, hearing the news that both had been killed and everything lost, the Dutch army setting their house aflame, their flight into the countryside, his mother selling her gold jewelry, a piece at a time, in exchange for food. Things would be changing, now that the Dutch had been driven out, Lolo had told her. He would return and teach at the university, be part of that change. He didn't talk that way anymore. In fact, it seemed as though he barely spoke to her at all, only out of necessity, or when spoken to. And even then, only of the task at hand, preparing a leak or planning a trip to visit some distant cousin. It was as if he had pulled into some dark hidden place, out of reach, taking with him the brightest part of himself. On some nights she would hear him up after everyone else had gone to bed, wandering through the house with a bottle of imported whiskey, nursing his secrets. Other nights he would tuck a pistol under his pillow before falling off to sleep. Whenever she asked him what was wrong, he would gently rebuff her, saying he was just tired. It was as if he had come to mistrust words somehow. Words and the sentiments words carried. She suspected these problems had something to do with Lolo's job. When she arrived, he was working for the army as a geologist, surveying roads and tunnels. It was mind-numbing work that didn't pay very much. The refrigerator alone cost 2 months' salary. And now, with a wife and child to provide for, no wonder he was depressed. She hadn't traveled all this way to be a burden, she decided. She would carry her own weight. She found herself a job right away, teaching English to Indonesian businessmen at the American Embassy, part of the U.S. foreign aid package to developing countries. The money helped, but didn't relieve her loneliness. The Indonesian businessmen weren't much interested in the niceties of the English language, and several made passes at her. The Americans were mostly older men, careerists in the State Department. The occasional economists or journalists who would mysteriously disappear for months at a time, their affiliation or function in the embassy never quite clear. Some of them were caricatures of the ugly American, prone to making jokes about Indonesians until they found out that she was married to one. And then they would try to play it off. Oh, don't take Jim too seriously. The heat's gotten to him. How's your son, by the way? Fine, fine boy. These men knew the country, though, or parts of it anyway. The closets where the skeletons were buried. Over lunch or casual conversation, they would share with her things she couldn't learn in the published news reports. They explained how Sukarno had frayed badly on the nerves of a U.S. government already obsessed with the march of communism through Indochina. What with his nationalist rhetoric and his politics of non-alignment, he was as bad as Lumumba or Nasser, only worse, given Indonesia's strategic importance. Word was that the CIA had played a part in the coup, although nobody knew for sure. More certain was the fact that after the coup, the military had swept the countryside for supposed communist sympathizers. The death toll was anybody's guess. A few hundred thousand, maybe, half a million. Even the smart guys at the agency had lost count. Innuendo, half-whispered asides. That's how my mother found out that we had arrived in Jakarta less than a year after one of the more brutal and swift campaigns of suppression in modern times. The idea frightened her. The notion that history could be swallowed up so completely, the same way the rich and loamy earth could soak up the rivers of blood that had once coursed through the streets, the way people could continue about their business beneath giant posters of the new president as if nothing had happened, a nation busy developing itself. As her circle of Indonesian friends widened, a few of them would be willing to tell her other stories about the corruption that pervaded government agencies, the shakedowns by police and the military, entire industries carved out for the president's family and entourage. And with each new story, my mother would go to Lolo in private and ask him, "Is it true?" He would never say. The more she asked, the more steadfast he became in his good-natured silence. "Why are you worrying about such talk?" he would ask her. "Why don't you buy a new dress for the party?" She had finally complained to one of Lolo's cousins, a pediatrician who had helped look after Lolo during the war. "You don't understand," the cousin had told her gently. "Understand what?" my mother asked. "The circumstances of Lolo's return," the cousin said. "He hadn't planned on coming back from Hawaii so early, you know. During the purge, all students studying abroad had been summoned without explanations. Their passports revoked. When Lolo stepped off the plane, he had no idea what might happen to him next. We couldn't see him. The army officials took him away and questioned him. They told him that he had just been conscripted and would be going to the jungles of New Guinea for a year. And he was one of the lucky ones. Students studying in the Eastern Bloc countries did much worse. Many of them are still in jail, or vanished." "So you see, you shouldn't be too hard on Lolo," the cousin said. "Such times are best forgotten." My mother had left the cousin's house in a daze. Outside, the sun was high, the air full of dust. But instead of taking a taxi home, she began to walk without direction. She found herself in a wealthy neighborhood, where the diplomats and generals lived in sprawling houses with tall, wrought iron gates. She saw a woman in bare feet and a tattered shawl wandering through an open gate and up the driveway, where a group of men were washing a fleet of Mercedes-Benzes and Land Rovers. One of the men shouted at the woman to leave, but the woman stood where she was, a bony arm stretched out before her, her face shrouded in shadow. Another man finally dug in his pocket and threw out a handful of coins. The woman ran after the coins with terrible speed, checking the road suspiciously as she gathered them into her bosom. Power. The word fixed in my mother's mind like a curse. In America, it had generally remained hidden from view until you dug beneath the surface of things, until you visited an Indian reservation or spoke to a black person whose trust you had earned. But here, power was undisguised, indiscriminate, naked, always fresh in the memory. Power had taken Lolo and yanked him back into line just when he thought he had escaped, making him feel its weight, letting him know that his life wasn't his own. That's how things were. You couldn't change it. You could just live by the rules, so simple once you learned them. And so Lolo had made his peace with power, learning the wisdom of forgetting, just as Lolo's brother-in-law had done, making millions as a high official in the National Oil Company, just as another brother had tried to do, only he had miscalculated and was now reduced to stealing pieces of silverware whenever he came for a visit, selling them later for loose cigarettes. My mother remembered what Lolo had told her once when her constant questioning had finally touched a nerve. Guilt is a luxury only foreigners can afford, he had said. Like saying whatever pops into your head. She didn't know what it was like to lose everything, to wake up and feel her belly eating itself. She didn't know how crowded and treacherous the path to security could be. Without absolute concentration, one could easily slip, tumble backwards. He was right, of course. My mother was a foreigner, middle class, and white, and protected by her heredity, whether she wanted protection or not. She could always leave if things got too messy. That possibility negated anything she might say to Lolo. It was the unbreachable barrier between them. She looked out the window now and saw that Lolo and I had moved on. The grass flattened where the two of us had been. The sight made her shudder slightly, and she rose to her feet, filled with a sudden panic. Power was taking her son. Looking back, I'm not sure that Lolo ever fully understood what my mother was going through during these years, why the things he was working so hard to provide for her seemed only to increase the distance between them. He was not a man to ask himself such questions. Instead, he maintained his concentration, and over the period that we lived in Indonesia, he proceeded to climb. With the help of his brother-in-law, he landed a new job in the government relations office of an American oil company. We moved to a house in a better neighborhood, a car replaced the motorcycle, a television and hi-fi replaced the crocodiles and Tata the ape. Lolo could sign for our dinners at a company club. Sometimes I would overhear him and my mother arguing in their bedroom, usually about her refusal to attend his company dinner parties, where American businessmen from Texas and Louisiana would slap Lolo's back and boast about the palms they had greased to obtain the new offshore drilling rights, while their wives complained to my mother about the quality of Indonesian help. He would ask her how it would look for him to go alone, and remind her that these were her own people, and my mother's voice would rise up to almost a shout, "They are not my people." Such arguments were rare, though. My mother and Lolo would remain cordial through the birth of my sister, Maya, through the separation and eventual divorce, up until the last time I saw Lolo, 10 years later, when my mother helped him travel to Los Angeles to treat a liver ailment that would kill him at the age of 51. What tension I noticed had mainly to do with the gradual shift in my mother's attitude toward me. She had always encouraged my rapid acculturation in Indonesia. It had made me relatively self-sufficient, undemanding on a tight budget, and extremely well-mannered when compared to other American children. She had taught me to disdain the blend of ignorance and arrogance that all too often characterized Americans abroad. But she now had learned, just as Lolo had learned, the chasm that separated the life chances of an American from those of an Indonesian. She knew which side of the divide she wanted her child to be on. I was an American, she decided, and my true life lay elsewhere. Her initial efforts centered on education. Without the money to send me to the international school, where most of Jakarta's foreign children went, she had arranged, from the moment of our arrival, to supplement my Indonesian schooling with lessons from a U.S. correspondence course. Her efforts now redoubled. 5 days a week, she came into my room at 4 a.m, force-fed me breakfast, and proceeded to teach me my English lessons for 3 hours before I left for school and she went to work. I offered stiff resistance to this regimen, but in response to every strategy I concocted, whether unconvincing, my stomach hurts, or indisputably true, my eyes kept closing every 5 minutes. She would patiently repeat her most powerful defense. "This is no picnic for me either, Buster." Then there were the periodic concerns with my safety, the voice of my grandmother ascendant. I remember coming home after dark one day to find a large search party of neighbors that had been assembled in our yard. My mother didn't look happy, but she was so relieved to see me that it took her several minutes to notice a wet sock, brown with mud, wrapped around my forearm. "What's that?" my mother asked. "What?" I said. "That. Why do you have a sock wrapped around your arm?" I cut myself. "Let's see. It's not that bad. Barry, let me see it." I unwrapped the sock, exposing a long gash that ran from my wrist to my elbow. It had missed the vein by an inch, but ran deeper at the muscle, where pinkish flesh pulsed from under the skin. Hoping to calm her down, I explained what had happened. A friend and I had hitchhiked out to his family farm, and it started to rain, and on the farm was a terrific place to mudslide, and there was this barbed wire fence that marked the farm's boundary, and... Lolo? My mother laughs at this point when she tells the story, the laugh of a mother forgiving her child those sins that have passed. But her tone alters slightly, as she remembers that Lolo suggested we wait until morning to get me stitched up, and that she had to browbeat our only neighbor with a car to drive us to the hospital. She remembers that most of the lights were out at the hospital when we arrived, with no receptionist in sight. She recalls the sound of her frantic footsteps echoing through the hallway until she finally found two young men in boxer shorts playing dominoes in a small room in the back. When she asked them where the doctors were, the men cheerfully replied, "We are the doctors," and went on to finish their game before slipping on their trousers and giving me 20 stitches that would leave an ugly scar. And through it all was the pervading sense that her child's life might slip away when she wasn't looking, that everyone else around her would be too busy trying to survive to notice, that when it counted, she would have plenty of sympathy, but no one beside her who believed in fighting against a threatening fate. It was those sorts of issues, I realize now, less tangible than school transcripts or medical services, that became the focus of her lessons with me. "If you want to grow into a human being," she would say to me, "you're going to need some values." Honesty. Lolo should not have hidden the refrigerator in the storage room when the tax officials came, even if everyone else, including the tax officials, expected such things. Fairness. The parents of wealthier students should not give television sets to the teachers during Ramadan, and their children could take no pride in the higher marks they might have received. Straight talk. If you didn't like the shirt I bought for your birthday, you should have just said so, instead of keeping it wadded up at the bottom of your closet. Independent judgment. Just because the other children tease the poor boy about his haircut doesn't mean you have to do it too. It was as if, by traveling halfway around the globe, away from the smugness and hypocrisy that familiarity had disclosed, my mother could give voice to the virtues of her Midwestern past and offer them up in distilled form. The problem was that she had few reinforcements. Whenever she took me aside for such commentary, I would dutifully nod my assent, but she must have known that many of her ideas seemed rather impractical. Lolo had merely explained the poverty, the corruption, the constant scramble for security. He hadn't created it. It remained all around me and bred a relentless skepticism. My mother's confidence in needlepoint virtues depended on a faith I didn't possess, a faith that she would refuse to describe as religious, that in fact her experience told her was sacrilegious, a faith that rational, thoughtful people could shape their own destiny. In a land where fatalism remained a necessary tool for enduring hardship, where ultimate truths were kept separate from day-to-day realities, she was a lonely witness for secular humanism, a soldier for New Deal, Peace Corps, position paper liberalism. She had only one ally in all this, and that was the distant authority of my father. Increasingly, she would remind me of his story, how he had grown up poor in a poor country, in a poor continent, how his life had been hard as anything that Lolo might have known. He hadn't cut corners, though, or played all the angles. He was diligent and honest, no matter what it cost him. He had led his life according to principles that demanded a different kind of toughness, principles that promised a higher form of power. I would follow his example, my mother decided. I had no choice. It was in the genes. "You have me to thank for your eyebrows," my mother said. "Your father had these little wispy eyebrows that don't amount to much. But your brains, your character, you got from him." Her message came to embrace black people generally. She would come home with books on the civil rights movement, the recordings of Mahalia Jackson, the speeches of Dr. King. When she told me stories of school children in the South who were forced to read books handed down from wealthier white schools, but who went on to become doctors and lawyers and scientists, I felt chastened by my reluctance to wake up and study in the mornings. If I told her about the goose-stepping demonstrations my Indonesian Boy Scout troop performed in front of the president, she might mention a different kind of march. A march of children no older than me, a march for freedom. Every black man was Thurgood Marshall or Sidney Poitier, every black woman Fannie Lou Hamer or Lena Horne. To be black was to be the beneficiary of a great inheritance, a special destiny, glorious burdens that only we were strong enough to bear. Burdens we were to carry with style. More than once, my mother would point out, Harry Belafonte is the best-looking man on the planet. It was in this context that I came across the picture in Life magazine of the black man who had tried to peel off his skin. I imagine other black children, then and now, undergoing similar moments of revelation. Perhaps it comes sooner for most. The parents' warning not to cross the boundaries of a particular neighborhood, or the frustration of not having hair like Barbie no matter how long you tease and comb, or the tale of a father's or grandfather's humiliation at the hands of an employer or a cop overheard while you're supposed to be asleep. Maybe it's easier for a child to receive the bad news in small doses, allowing for a system of defenses to build up. Although I suspect I was one of the luckier ones, having been given a stretch of childhood free from self-doubt. I know that seeing that article was violent for me, an ambush attack. My mother had warned me about bigots. They were ignorant, uneducated people that one should avoid. If I could not yet consider my own mortality, Lolo had helped me understand the potential of disease to cripple, of accidents to maim, of fortunes to decline. I could correctly identify common greed or cruelty in others, and sometimes even in myself. But that one photograph had told me something else, that there was a hidden enemy out there, one that could reach me without anyone's knowledge, not even my own. When I got home that night from the embassy library, I went into the bathroom and stood in front of the mirror, with all my senses and limbs seemingly intact, looking as I had always looked, and wondered if something was wrong with me. The alternative seemed no less frightening, that the adults around me lived in the midst of madness. The initial flush of anxiety would pass, and I would spend my remaining year in Indonesia much as I had before. I retained a confidence that was not always justified, and an irrepressible talent for mischief. But my vision had been permanently altered. On the imported television shows that had started running in the evenings in Indonesia, I began to notice that Cosby never got the girl on I Spy, that the black man on Mission Impossible spent all his time underground. I noticed that there was nobody like me in the Sears Roebuck Christmas catalog that Toot and Gramps sent to us, and that Santa was a white man. I kept these observations to myself, deciding that either my mother didn't see them, or she was trying to protect me, and that I shouldn't expose her efforts as having failed. I still trusted my mother's love, but I faced the prospect that her account of the world and my father's place in it was somehow incomplete. It took me a while to recognize them in the crowd. When the sliding doors first parted, all I could make out was the blur of smiling, anxious faces tilted over the guardrail. Eventually, I spotted a tall, silver-haired man towards the rear of the crowd, with a short, owlish woman barely visible beside him. Toot gathered me into a hug and tossed candy and chewing gum Lays around my neck. Gramps threw an arm over my shoulder. They took me to the new car they had bought, and Gramps showed me how to operate the air conditioning. We drove along the highway, past fast food restaurants and economy motels, and used car lots strung with festoons. I told them about the trip and everyone back in Jakarta. Gramps told me what they'd planned for my welcome back dinner. Toot suggested I needed new clothes for school. Then, suddenly, the conversation stopped. I realized that I was to live with strangers. The new arrangement hadn't sounded so bad when my mother first explained it to me. It was time for me to attend an American school, she had said. I'd run through all the lessons in my correspondence course. She said that she and Maya would be joining me in Hawaii very soon, a year, tops, and that she'd try to make it there for Christmas. She reminded me of what a great time I'd had living with Gramps and Toot just the previous summer, the ice cream, the cartoons, the days at the beach. "And you won't have to wake up at 4 in the morning, she said, a point that I found most compelling. It was only now, as I began to adjust to an indefinite stay and watch my grandparents in the rhythm of their schedules, that I realized how much the two of them had changed. After my mother and I had left, they had sold the big rambling house near the university and now rented a small 2-bedroom apartment in a high-rise on Baratania Street. Gramps had left the furniture business to become a life insurance agent, but as he was unable to convince himself that people needed what he was selling and was sensitive to rejection, the work went badly. Every Sunday night, I would watch him grow more and more irritable as he gathered up his briefcase and set up a TV tray in front of his chair, following the lead of every possible distraction until he would finally chase us out of the living room and try to schedule appointments with prospective clients over the phone. Sometimes I would tiptoe into the kitchen for a soda, and I could hear the desperation creeping out of his voice, the stretch of silence that followed when the people on the other end explained why Thursday wasn't good and Tuesday not much better, and then Gramps' heavy sigh after he had hung up the phone, his hands fumbling through the files in his lap like those of a card player who's deep in the hole. Often, my grandparents argued, an argument rooted in the rarely mentioned fact that Toot earned more money than Gramps. She had proved to be a trailblazer of sorts, the first woman vice president of a local bank, and although Gramps liked to say he always encouraged her in her career, her job had become a source of delicacy and bitterness between them, as his commissions paid fewer and fewer of the family's bills. Not that Toot had anticipated her success. Without a college education, she had started out as a secretary to help defray the costs of my unexpected birth, but she had a quick mind and sound judgment and the capacity for sustained work. Slowly she had risen, playing by the rules, until she reached the threshold where competence didn't suffice. There she would stay for 20 years, with scarcely a vacation, watching her male counterparts keep moving up the corporate ladder, playing a bit loose with information passed on between the ninth hole and the ride to the clubhouse, becoming wealthy men. More than once, my mother would tell Toot that the bank shouldn't get away with such blatant sexism. But Toot would just poo-poo my mother's remarks, saying that everybody could find a reason to complain about something. Toot didn't complain. Every morning, she woke up at 5 a.m. and changed from the frowsy muumuus she wore around the apartment into a tailored suit and high-heeled pumps. Her face powdered, her hips girdled, her thinning hair bolstered, she would board the 6:30 bus to arrive at her downtown office before anyone else. From time to time, she would admit a grudging pride in her work, and took pleasure in telling us the inside story behind the local financial news. When I got older, though, she would confide in me that she had never stopped dreaming of a house with a white picket fence, days spent baking or playing bridge or volunteering at the local library. I was surprised by this admission, for she rarely mentioned hopes or regrets. It may or may not have been true that she would have preferred the alternative history she imagined for herself, but I came to understand that her career spanned a time when the work of a wife outside the home was nothing to brag about, for her or for Gramps, that it represented only lost years, broken promises. What Toot believed kept her going were the needs of her grandchildren and the stoicism of her ancestors. "So long as you kids do well, Bear," she would say more than once, "that's all that really matters." That's how my grandparents had come to live. They still prepared sashimi for the now infrequent guests to their apartment. Gramps still wore Hawaiian shirts to the office, and Toot still insisted on being called Toot. Otherwise, though, the ambitions they had carried with them to Hawaii had slowly drained away, until regularity of schedules and pastimes and the weather became their principal consolation. They would occasionally grumble about how the Japanese had taken over the islands, how the Chinese controlled island finance. During the Watergate hearings, my mother would pry out of them that they had voted for Nixon, the law and order candidate, in 1968. We didn't go to the beach or on hikes together anymore. At night, Gramps watched television while Toot sat in her room reading murder mysteries. Their principal excitement now came from new drapes or a standalone freezer. It was as if they had bypassed the satisfaction that should come with the middle years, the convergence of maturity with time left, energy with means, a recognition of accomplishment that frees the spirit. At some point in my absence, they had decided to cut their losses and settle for hanging on. They saw no more destinations to hope for. As the summer drew to a close, I became increasingly restless to start school. My main concern was finding companions my own age, but for my grandparents, my admission into Punahou Academy heralded the start of something grand, an elevation in the family status that they took great pains to let everyone know. Started by missionaries in 1841, Punahou had grown into a prestigious prep school, an incubator for island elites. Its reputation had helped sway my mother in her decision to send me back to the States. "It hadn't been easy to get me in," my grandparents told her. There was a long waiting list, and I was considered only because of the intervention of Gramps' boss, who was an alumnus. My first experience with affirmative action, it seems, had little to do with race. So it was with a great rush of excitement that Gramps dropped me off in front of a large white stucco building for my first day of school. Inside, I sat at a table with four other children, and Miss Hefty, an energetic, middle-aged woman with short gray hair, took attendance. When she read my full name, I heard titters break across the room. A boy I had been talking to leaned over to me. "I thought your name was Barry," he said. Would you prefer if we called you Barry? Miss Hefty asked. Barack is such a beautiful name. Your grandfather tells me your father is Kenyan. I used to live in Kenya, you know, teaching children just your age. It's such a magnificent country. Do you know what tribe your father is from? Her question brought on more giggles, and I remained speechless for a moment. When I finally said Luo, a sandy-haired boy behind me repeated the word with a loud hoot, like the sound of a monkey. The children could no longer contain themselves, and it took a stern reprimand from Miss Hefty before the class would settle down and we could mercifully move on to the next person on the list. It was a 10-year-old's nightmare. Still, in my discomfort that first month, I was no worse off than the other children who were relegated to the category of misfits, the girls who were too tall or too shy, the boy who was mildly hyperactive, the kids whose asthma excused them from P.E. There was one child in my class, though, who reminded me of a different sort of pain. Her name was Coretta, and before my arrival, she had been the only black person in our grade. She was plump and dark and didn't seem to have many friends. From the first day, we avoided each other, but watched from a distance, as if direct contact would only remind us more keenly of our isolation. Finally, during recess one hot, cloudless day, we found ourselves occupying the same corner of the playground. I don't remember what we said to each other, but I remember that suddenly she was chasing me around the jungle gyms and swings. She was laughing brightly, and I teased her and dodged this way and that until she finally caught me and we fell to the ground breathless. When I looked up, I saw a group of children, faceless before the glare of the sun, pointing down at us. Coretta has a boyfriend. Coretta has a boyfriend. The chants grew louder as more kids circled around us. She's not my girlfriend, I stammered. I looked to Coretta for some assistance, but she just stood there looking down at the ground. Coretta's got a boyfriend. Why don't you kiss her, Mr. Boyfriend? I'm not her boyfriend, I shouted. I ran up to Coretta and gave her a slight shove. She staggered back and looked up at me, but still said nothing. Leave me alone, I shouted again. And suddenly Coretta was running, faster and faster, until she disappeared from sight. Appreciative laughs rose around me. Then the bell rang, and the teachers appeared to round us back into class. For the rest of the afternoon, I was haunted by the look on Coretta's face just before she had started to run, her disappointment, and the accusation. I wanted to explain to her somehow that it had been nothing personal. I just never had a girlfriend before, and I saw no particular need to have one now. But I didn't even know if that was true. I knew only that it was too late for explanations, that somehow I had been tested and found wanting. And whenever I snuck a glance at Coretta's desk, I would see her with her head bent over her work, appearing as if nothing had happened, pulled into herself, and asking no favors. My act of betrayal bought me some room from the other children, and like Coretta, I was mostly left alone. I made a few friends and managed to toss a wobbly football around, but from that day forward, a part of me felt trampled on, crushed, and I took refuge in the life that my grandparents led. After school let out, I would walk the 5 blocks to our apartment. If I had any change in my pocket, I might stop off at a newsstand run by a blind man who would let me know what new comics had come in. Gramps would be at home to let me into the apartment, and as he lay down for his afternoon nap, I would watch cartoons and sitcom reruns. At 4:30, I would wake Gramps, and we would drive downtown to pick up Toot. My homework would be done in time for dinner, which we ate in front of the television. There I would stay for the rest of the evening, negotiating with Gramps over which programs to watch, sharing the latest snack food he'd discovered at the supermarket. At 10 o'clock, I went to my room. Johnny Carson came on at that time, and there was no negotiating around that. And I would fall asleep to the sounds of Top 40 on the radio. Nestled in the soft, forgiving bosom of America's consumer culture, I felt safe. It was as if I had dropped into a long hibernation. I wonder sometimes how long I might have stayed there had it not been for the telegram Toot found in the mailbox one day. Your father's coming to see you, Toot said. Next month, 2 weeks after your mother gets here. They'll both stay through New Year's. She carefully folded the paper and slipped it into a drawer in the kitchen. Both she and Gramps fell silent, the way I imagine people react when the doctor tells them they have a serious but curable illness. For a moment, the air was sucked out of the room, and we stood suspended, alone with our thoughts. Well, Toot said finally, I suppose we better start looking for a place where he can stay. Gramps took off his glasses and rubbed his eyes. Should be one hell of a Christmas. Over lunch, I explained to a group of boys that my father was a prince. My grandfather, see, he's a chief. It's sort of like the king of a tribe, you know, like the Indians. So that makes my father a prince. He'll take over when my grandfather dies. What about after that? One of my friends asked as we emptied our trays into the trash bin. I mean, will you go back and be a prince? Well, if I want to, I could. It's sort of complicated, see, because the tribe is full of warriors. Like Obama, that means burning spear. The men in our tribe all want to be chief, so my father has to settle these feuds before I can come. As the words tumbled out of my mouth, and I felt the boys readjust to me, more curious and familiar as we bumped into each other in the line back to class, a part of me really began to believe the story. But another part of me knew that what I was telling them was a lie, something I'd constructed from the scraps of information I'd picked up from my mother. After a week of my father in the flesh, I had decided that I preferred his more distant image, an image I could alter on a whim, or ignore when convenient. If my father hadn't exactly disappointed me, he remained something unknown, something volatile and vaguely threatening. Miss Hefty has invited your father to come to school on Thursday. She wants him to speak to the class, my mother told me. I couldn't imagine worse news. I spent that night and all the next day trying to suppress thoughts of the inevitable. The faces of my classmates when they heard about mud huts, the painful jokes afterwards. Each time I remembered, my body squirmed as if it had received a jolt to the nerves. I was still trying to figure out how I'd explain myself when my father walked into our class the next day. Miss Hefty welcomed him eagerly, and as I took my seat, I heard several children ask each other what was going on. I became more desperate when our math teacher, a big no-nonsense Hawaiian named Mr. Eldridge, came into the room, followed by 30 confused children from his homeroom next door. "We have a special treat for you today," Miss Hefty began. "Barry Obama's father is here, and he's come all the way from Kenya, in Africa, to tell us about his country." The other kids looked at me as my father stood up, and I held my head stiffly, trying to focus on a vacant point on the blackboard behind him. He had been speaking for some time before I could finally bring myself back to the moment. He was leaning against Miss Hefty's thick oak desk and describing the deep gash in the earth where mankind had first appeared. He spoke of the wild animals that still roamed the plains, the tribes that still required a young boy to kill a lion to prove his manhood. He spoke of the customs of the Luo, how elders received the utmost respect and made laws for all to follow under great trunk trees. He told us of Kenya's struggle to be free, how the British had wanted to stay and unjustly rule the people, just as they had in America, how many had been enslaved only because of the color of their skin, just as they had in America, but that Kenyans, like all of us in the room, longed to be free and develop themselves through hard work and sacrifice. When he finished, Miss Hefty was absolutely beaming with pride. All my classmates applauded heartily, and a few struck up the courage to ask questions, each of which my father appeared to consider carefully before answering. The bell rang for lunch, and Mr. Eldridge came up to me. "You've got a pretty impressive father." A month. That's how long we would have together. The five of us in my grandparents' living room most evenings, during the day on drives around the island, or on short walks past the private landmarks of a family. The lot where my father's apartment had once stood. The remodeled hospital where I had been born. My grandparents' first house in Hawaii, before the one on University Avenue, a house I had never known. There was so much to tell in that single month, so much explaining to do. And yet when I reach back into my memory for the words of my father, the small interactions or conversations we might have had, they seem irretrievably lost. Perhaps they're imprinted too deeply, his voice the seed of all sorts of tangled arguments I carry on with myself, as impenetrable now as the pattern of my genes, so that all I can perceive is the worn-out shell. My wife offers a simpler explanation. The boys and their fathers don't always have much to say to each other, unless and until they trust. And this may come closer to the mark, for I often felt mute before him, and he never pushed me to speak. I'm left mostly with images that appear and die off in my mind like distant sounds. his head thrown back in laughter at one of Gramps' jokes as my mother and I hang Christmas ornaments, his grip on my shoulder as he introduces me to one of his old friends from college, the narrowing of his eyes, the stroking of his sparse goatee as he reads his important books. Images and his effect on other people. For whenever he spoke, his one leg draped over the other, his large hands outstretched to direct or deflect attention, his voice deep and sure, cajoling and laughing, I would see a sudden change take place in the family. Gramps became more vigorous and thoughtful, my mother more bashful. Even Toot, smoked out of the foxhole of her bedroom, would start sparring with him about politics or finance, stabbing the air with her blue-veined hands to make a point. It was as if his presence had summoned the spirit of earlier times and allowed each of them to reprise his or her old role, as if Dr. King had never been shot, and the Kennedys continued to beckon the nation, and war and riot and famine were nothing more than temporary setbacks, and there was nothing to fear but fear itself. It fascinated me, the strange power of his, and for the first time I began to think of my father as something real and immediate, perhaps even permanent. 2 weeks later, he was gone. In that time, we stand together in front of the Christmas tree and pose for pictures, the only ones I have of us together. Me holding an orange basketball, his gift to me, him showing off the tie I've bought him. Ah, people will know that I am very important wearing such a tie. At a Dave Brubeck concert, I struggle to sit quietly in the dark auditorium beside him, unable to follow the spare equations of sound that the performers make, careful to clap whenever he claps. For brief spells in the day, I will lie beside him, the two of us alone in the apartment sublet from a retired old woman whose name I forget, the place full of quilts and doilies and knitted seat covers, and I read my book while he reads his. He remains opaque to me, a present mass. When I mimic his gestures or turns of phrase, I know neither their origins nor their consequences. Can't see how they play out over time. But I grow accustomed to his company. The day of his departure, as my mother and I helped him pack his bags, he unearthed two records, 45s, in dull brown dust jackets. Ah, Betty, look here. I forgot that I had brought these for you. The Sounds of Your Continent. It took him a while to puzzle out my grandparents' old stereo, but finally the disc began to turn, and he gingerly placed the needle on the groove. A tinny guitar lick opened, then the sharp horns, the thump of drums, then the guitar again, and then the voices, clean and joyful as they rode up the backbeat, urging us on. Come, Betty, my father said. You will learn from the master. And suddenly his slender body was swaying back and forth, the lush sound was rising, his arms were swinging as they cast an invisible net, his feet wove over the floor in off beats, his bad legs stiff but his rump high, his head back, his hips moving in a tight circle. The rhythm quickened, the horn sounded, and his eyes closed to follow his pleasure. And then one eye opened to peek down at me, and his solemn face spread into a silly grin, and my mother smiled, and my grandparents walked in to see what all the commotion was about. I took my first tentative steps with my eyes closed, down, up, my arms swinging, the voices lifting. And I hear him still. As I follow my father into the sound, he lets out a quick shout, bright and high, a shout that leaves much behind and reaches out for more, a shout that cries for laughter.
Man, I'm not going to any more of these bullshit Puno parties.
Yeah, that's what you said the last time. Ray and I sat down at a table and unwrapped our hamburgers. He was 2 years older than me, a senior who, as a result of his father's army transfer, had arrived from Los Angeles the previous year. Despite the difference in age, we'd fallen into an easy friendship, due in no small part to the fact that together, we made up almost half of Puno's black high school population. I enjoyed his company. He had a warmth and brash humor that made up for his constant references to a former L.A. life, the retinue of women who supposedly still called him long distance every night, his past football exploits, the celebrities he knew. Most of the things he told me I tended to discount, but not everything.
It was true, for example, that he was one of the fastest sprinters in the islands. Olympic caliber, some said. This despite an improbably large stomach that quivered under his sweat-soaked jersey whenever he ran and left coaches and opposing teams shaking their heads in disbelief. Through Ray, I would find out about the black parties that were happening at the university or out on the army bases, counting on him to ease my passage through unfamiliar terrain. In return, I gave him a sounding board for his frustrations. "I mean it this time," Ray was saying to me now. "These girls are A1 USDA certified racists. All of them. White girls, Asian girls, shoot, these Asians worse than the whites. Think we got a disease or something." "Maybe they're looking at that big butt of yours," I said. "Man, I thought you were in training." "Get your hands out of my fries," Ray responded. "You ain't my bitch, nigga. Buy your own damn fries. Now, what was I talking about?" "Just 'cause a girl don't go out with you," I said, "doesn't make her a racist. Don't be thick, all right? I'm not just talking about one time. Look, I asked Monica out, she says no. I say, okay, your shit's not so hot anyway." Ray stopped to check my reaction, then smiled. "All right, maybe I don't actually say all that. I just tell her, okay, Monica, you know, we still tight. Next thing I know, she's hooked up with Steve, No Neck, Yamaguchi. Two of them all holding hands and shit like a couple of lovebirds. So fine, I figure there's more fish in the sea. I go ask Pamela out. She tells me she ain't going to the dance. I say, cool. Get to the dance. Guess who's standing there? Got her arms around Rick Cook. Hi, Ray, she says, like she don't know what's going down. Rick Cook. Now, you know that guy ain't shit. Sorry ass motherfucker got nothing on me, right? Nothing." He stuffed a handful of fries into his mouth. "Ain't just me, by the way. I don't see you doing any better in the booty department." Because I'm shy, I thought to myself. But I would never admit that to him. Ray pressed the advantage. "So what happens when we go out to a party with some sisters, huh? What happens? I tell you what happens. Blam! They on us like there's no tomorrow. High school chicks, university chicks, it don't matter. They acting sweet, all smiles. Sure you can have my number, baby. Bet." "Well," I hesitated. "Well, what?" Ray continued. "Listen, why don't you get more playing time on the basketball team, huh? At least two guys ahead of you ain't nothing, and you know it, and they know it. I seen you tear them up on the playground, no contest. Why wasn't I starting on the football squad this season, no matter how many passes the other guy dropped? Tell me we wouldn't be treated different if we was white, or Japanese, or Hawaiian, or fucking Eskimo." "That's not what I'm saying," I answered. "So what are you saying?" "All right, here's what I'm saying. I'm saying, yeah, it's harder to get dates because there aren't any black girls around here. But that don't make the girls that are here all racist. Maybe they just want somebody that looks like their daddy, or their brother, or whatever, and we ain't it. I'm saying, yeah, I might not get breaks on the team that some guys get, but they play like white boys do, and that's the style the coach likes to play, and they're winning the way they play. I don't play that way. As for your greasy mouth self," I added, reaching for the last of his fries, "I'm saying the coaches may not like you because you're a smart-ass black man, but it might help if you stopped eating all them fries you eat, making you look 6 months pregnant. That's what I'm saying." "Man, I don't know why you're making excuses for these folks." Ray got up and crumpled his trash into a tight ball. "Let's get out of here. Your shit's getting way too complicated for me." Things had got complicated. It had been 5 years since my father's visit, and on the surface at least, it had been a placid time, marked by the usual rites and rituals that America expects from its children. Marginal report cards and calls to the principal's office, part-time jobs at the burger chain, acne and driving tests and turbulent desire. I'd made my share of friends at school, gone on the occasional awkward date, and if I sometimes puzzled over the mysterious realignments of status that took place among my classmates, as some rose and others fell depending on the whims of their bodies or the make of their cars, I took comfort in the knowledge that my own position had steadily improved. Rarely did I meet kids whose families had less than mine and might remind me of good fortune. My mother did her best to remind me. She had separated from Lolo and returned to Hawaii to pursue a master's degree in anthropology shortly after my own arrival. For 3 years, I lived with her and Maya in a small apartment a block away from Punahou, my mother's student grant supporting the three of us. Sometimes, when I brought friends home after school, my mother would overhear them remark about the lack of food in the fridge or the less-than-perfect housekeeping, and she would pull me aside and let me know that she was a single mother going to school again and raising two kids, and that baking cookies wasn't exactly at the top of her priority list, and while she appreciated the fine education I was receiving at Punahou, she wasn't planning on putting up with any snotty attitudes from me or anyone else. Was that understood? It was understood. Despite my frequent and sometimes sullen claims of independence, the two of us remained close, and I did my best to help her out where I could, shopping for groceries, doing the laundry, looking after the knowing, dark-eyed child that my sister had become. But when my mother was ready to return to Indonesia to do her field work and suggested that I go back with her and Maya to attend international school there, I immediately said no. I doubted what Indonesia now had to offer and wearied of being new all over again. More than that, I'd arrived at an unspoken pact with my grandparents. I could live with them, and they'd leave me alone so long as I kept my trouble out of sight. The arrangement suited my purpose, a purpose that I could barely articulate to myself, much less to them. Away from my mother, away from my grandparents, I was engaged in a fitful interior struggle. I was trying to raise myself to be a black man in America, and beyond the given of my appearance, no one around me seemed to know exactly what that meant. My father's letters provided few clues. They would arrive sporadically, on a single blue page with gummed-down flaps that obscured any writing at the margins. He would report that everything was fine, commend me on my progress in school, and insist that my mother, Maya, and I were all welcome to take our rightful place beside him whenever we so desired. From time to time he would include advice, usually in the form of aphorisms that I didn't quite understand. Like water finding its level, you will arrive at a career that suits you. I would respond promptly, on a wide-ruled page, and his letters would find their way into the closet next to my mother's pictures of him. TV, movies, the radio, those were the places to start. Pop culture was color-coded, after all, an arcade of images from which you could cop a walk, a talk, a step, a style. I couldn't croon like Marvin Gaye, but I could learn to dance all the Soul Train steps. I couldn't pack a gun like Shaft or Superfly, but I could sure enough curse like Richard Pryor. And I could play basketball, with a consuming passion that would always exceed my limited talent. I was living out a caricature of black male adolescence, itself a caricature of swaggering American manhood. Yet at a time when boys aren't supposed to want to follow their father's tired footsteps, when the imperatives of harvest or work in a factory aren't supposed to dictate identity, so that how to live is bought off a rack or found in magazines, the principal difference between me and most of the man boys around me, the surfers, the football players, the would-be rock and roll guitarists, resided in the limited number of options at my disposal. Each of us chose a costume, armor against uncertainty. At least on the basketball court, I could find a community of sorts, with an inner life all its own. It was there that I would make my closest white friends, on turf where blackness couldn't be a disadvantage. And it was there that I would meet Ray and the other blacks close to my age who had begun to trickle into the islands, teenagers whose confusion and anger would help shape my own. "That's just how white folks will do you," one of my African-American friends might say when we were alone. Everybody would chuckle and shake their heads, and my mind would run down a ledger of slights. The first boy in seventh grade who called me a coon, his tears of surprise, "Why'd you do that?" when I gave him a bloody nose. The tennis pro who told me during a tournament that I shouldn't touch the schedule of matches pinned to the bulletin board because my color might rub off. His thin-lipped, red-faced smile, "Can't you take a joke?" when I threatened to report him. The older woman in my grandparents' apartment building who became agitated when I got on the elevator behind her and ran out to tell the manager that I was following her. Her refusal to apologize when she was told that I lived in the building. Our assistant basketball coach, a young wiry man from New York with a nice jumper, who after a pickup game with some talkative black men, had muttered within earshot of me and three of my teammates that we shouldn't have lost to a bunch of niggers, and who, when I told him, with a fury that surprised even me, to shut up, had calmly explained the apparently obvious fact that there are black people and there are niggers. These guys were niggers. That's just how white folks will do you. It wasn't merely the cruelty involved. I was learning that black people could be mean and then some. It was a particular brand of arrogance, an obtuseness in otherwise sane people that brought forth our bitter laughter. It was as if whites didn't know they were being cruel in the first place, or at least thought you deserving of their scorn. White folks. The term itself was uncomfortable in my mouth at first. I felt like a non-native speaker tripping over a difficult phrase. Sometimes, I would find myself talking to Ray about white folks this or white folks that, and I would suddenly remember my mother's smile, and the words that I spoke would seem awkward and false. Or I would be helping Gramps dry the dishes after dinner, and Toot would come in to say she was going to sleep, and those same words, white folks, would flash in my head like a bright neon sign, and I would grow suddenly quiet, as if I had secrets to keep. Later, when I was alone, I would try to untangle these difficult thoughts. It was obvious that certain whites could be exempted from the general category of our distrust. Ray was always telling me how cool my grandparents were. The term white was simply a shorthand for him, I decided, a tag for what my mother would call a bigot. And although I recognized the risks in his terminology, how easy it was to fall into the same sloppy thinking that my basketball coach had displayed, "There are white folks, and then there are ignorant motherfuckers like you," I'd finally told the coach before walking off the court that day. Ray assured me that we would never talk about whites, as whites, in front of whites, without knowing exactly what we were doing, without knowing that there might be a price to pay. But was that right? Was there still a price to pay? That was the complicated part, the thing that Ray and I could never seem to agree on. There were times when I would listen to him tell some blonde girl he'd just met about life on LA's mean streets, or hear him explain the scars of racism to some eager young teacher, and I could swear that just beneath the sober expression, Ray was winking at me, letting me in on the score. Our rage at the white world needed no object, he seemed to be telling me, no independent confirmation. It could be switched on and off at our pleasure. Sometimes, after one of his performances, I would question his judgment, if not his sincerity. We weren't living in the Jim Crow South, I would remind him. We weren't consigned to some heatless housing project in Harlem or the Bronx. We were in goddamn Hawaii. We said what we pleased, ate where we pleased, we sat in the front of the proverbial bus. None of our white friends, guys like Jeff or Scott from the basketball team, treated us any differently than they treated each other. They loved us and we loved them back. Seemed like half of them wanted to be black themselves, or at least Dr. J. Well, that's true, Ray would admit. Maybe we could afford to give the badass nigger pose a rest. Save it for when we really needed it. And Ray would shake his head. A pose, huh? Speak for your own self. And I would know that Ray had flashed his trump card, one that, to his credit, he rarely played. I was different, after all, potentially suspect. I had no idea who my own self was. Unwilling to risk exposure, I would quickly retreat to safer ground. Perhaps if we had been living in New York or L.A., I would have been quicker to pick up on the rules of the high-stake game we were playing. As it was, I learned to slip back and forth between my black and white worlds, understanding that each possessed its own language and customs and structures of meaning, convinced that with a bit of translation on my part, the two worlds would eventually cohere. Still, the feeling that something wasn't quite right stayed with me, a warning that sounded whenever a white girl mentioned in the middle of conversation how much she liked Stevie Wonder, or when a woman in the supermarket asked me if I played basketball, or when the school principal told me I was cool. I did like Stevie Wonder. I did love basketball, and I tried my best to be cool at all times. So why did such comments always set me on edge? There was a trick there somewhere, although what the trick was, who was doing the tricking, and who was being tricked, eluded my conscious grasp. I gathered up books from the library, Baldwin, Ellison, Hughes, Wright, Du Bois. At night, I would close the door to my room, telling my grandparents I had homework to do, and there I would sit and wrestle with words, locked in suddenly desperate argument, trying to reconcile the world as I had found it with the terms of my birth. But there was no escape to be had. In every page of every book, in Bigger Thomas and Invisible Men, I kept finding the same anguish, the same doubt, a self-contempt that neither irony nor intellect seemed able to deflect. Even Du Bois' learning and Baldwin's love and Langston's humor eventually succumbed to its corrosive force, each man finally forced to doubt art's redemptive power, each man finally forced to withdraw, one to Africa, one to Europe, one deeper into the bowels of Harlem, but all of them in the same weary flight, all of them exhausted, bitter men, the devil at their heels. Only Malcolm X's autobiography seemed to offer something different. His repeated acts of self-creation spoke to me. The blunt poetry of his words, his unadorned insistence on respect, promised a new and uncompromising order, martial in its discipline, forged through sheer force of will. All the other stuff, the talk of blue-eyed devils and apocalypse, was incidental to that program, I decided. religious baggage that Malcolm himself seemed to have safely abandoned towards the end of his life. And yet, even as I imagined myself following Malcolm's call, one line in the book stayed with me. He spoke of a wish he'd once had, the wish that the white blood that ran through him, there by an act of violence, might somehow be expunged. I knew that, for Malcolm, that wish would never be incidental. I knew as well that traveling down the road to self-respect, my own white blood would never recede into mere abstraction. I was left to wonder what else I would be severing if and when I left my mother and my grandparents at some uncharted border. One day, I awoke to the sound of an argument in the kitchen, my grandmother's voice barely audible, followed by my grandfather's deep growl. I opened my door to see Toot entering their bedroom to get dressed for work. I asked her what was wrong. "Nothing. Your grandfather just doesn't want to drive me to work this morning, that's all." When I entered the kitchen, Gramps was muttering under his breath. He poured himself a cup of coffee as I told him that I would be willing to give Toot a ride to work if he was tired. It was a bold offer, for I didn't like to wake up early. Gramps scowled at my suggestion. "That's not the point," Gramps said. "She just wants to make me feel bad." "I'm sure that's not it, Gramps," I said. "Of course it is," he said. He sipped from his coffee. "She's been catching the bus ever since she started at the bank. She said it was more convenient. And now, just because she gets pestered a little, she wants to change everything." Toot's diminutive figure hovered in the hall, peering at us from behind her bifocals. "That's not true, Stanley." I took her into the other room and asked her what had happened. "A man asked me for money yesterday, while I was waiting for the bus." "That's all?" Her lips pursed with irritation. "He was very aggressive, Barry. Very aggressive. I gave him a dollar and he kept asking. If the bus hadn't come, I think he might have hit me over the head." I returned to the kitchen. Gramps was rinsing his cup, his back turned to me. "Listen," I said, "why don't you just let me give her a ride, Gramps? She seems pretty upset." "By a panhandler?" "Yeah, I know, but it's probably a little scary for her, seeing some big man block her way. It's really no big deal." Gramps turned around, and I saw now that he was shaking. "It is a big deal. It's a big deal to me. She's been bothered by men before. You know why she's so scared this time? I'll tell you why. Before you came in, she told me the fellow was black." He whispered the word. "That's the real reason why she's bothered, and I just don't think that's right." The words were like a fist in my stomach, and I wobbled to regain my composure. In my steadiest voice, I told him that such an attitude bothered me too, but assured him that Toot's fears would pass, and that we should give her a ride in the meantime. Gramps slumped into the chair in the living room and said he was sorry he had told me. Before my eyes, he grew small and old and very sad. I put my hand on his shoulder and told him that it was all right. I understood. We remained like that for several minutes, in painful silence. Finally, he insisted that he drive Toot after all, and struggled up from his seat to get dressed. After they left, I sat on the edge of my bed and thought about my grandparents. They had sacrificed again and again for me. They had poured all their lingering hopes into my success. Never had they given me reason to doubt their love. I doubted if they ever would. And yet I knew that men who might easily have been my brothers could still inspire their rawest fears. I spent the last 2 years of high school in a daze, locking away the questions that life seemed insistent on posing. I kept playing basketball, attended classes sparingly, drank beer heavily, and tried drugs enthusiastically. I discovered that it didn't make any difference whether you smoked reefer in the white classmate's sparkling new van, or in the dorm room with some brother you'd met down at the gym, or on the beach with a couple of Hawaiian kids who had dropped out of school and now spent most of their time looking for an excuse to brawl. Nobody asked you whether your father was a fat cat executive who cheated on his wife, or some laid-off Joe who slapped you around whenever he bothered to come home. You might just be bored, or alone. Everybody was welcome into the club of disaffection. And if the high didn't solve whatever it was that was getting you down, it could at least help you laugh at the world's ongoing folly and see through all the hypocrisy and bullshit and cheap moralism. That's how it had seemed to me then, anyway. It had taken a couple of years before I saw how fates were beginning to play themselves out, the difference that color and money made, after all, in who survived, how soft or hard the landing when you finally fell. I tried to explain some of this to my mother once, the role of luck in the world, the spin of the wheel. It was at the start of my senior year in high school. She was back in Hawaii, her field work completed, and one day she marched into my room, wanting to know the details of my friend Pablo's recent arrest. I'd given her a reassuring smile and patted her hand and told her not to worry. I wouldn't do anything stupid. It was usually an effective tactic, another one of those tricks I had learned. People were satisfied so long as you were courteous and smiled and made no sudden moves. They were more than satisfied. They were relieved. Such a pleasant surprise to find a well-mannered young black man who didn't seem angry all the time. Except my mother hadn't looked satisfied. She had just sat there, studying my eyes, her face as grim as a hearse. "Don't you think you're being a little casual about your future?" she said. "What do you mean?" "You know exactly what I mean. One of your friends was just arrested for drug possession. Your grades are slipping. You haven't even started on your college applications. Whenever I try to talk to you about it, you act like I'm just this great big bother." I didn't need to hear all this. It wasn't like I was flunking out. I started to tell her how I'd been thinking about maybe not going away for college, how I could stay in Hawaii and take some classes and work part-time. She cut me off before I could finish. "I could get into any school in the country," she said, "if I just put in a little effort. Remember what that's like? Effort? Damn it, Bear, you can't just sit around like some good-time Charlie waiting for luck to see you through." I looked at her sitting there, so earnest, so certain in her son's destiny. The idea that my survival depended on luck remained a heresy to her. She insisted on assigning responsibility somewhere. To herself, to Gramps and Toot, to me. I suddenly felt like puncturing that certainty of hers, letting her know that her experiment with me had failed. Instead of shouting, I laughed. "A good time, Charlie, huh? Well, why not? Maybe that's what I want out of life. I mean, look at Gramps. He didn't even go to college." The comparison caught my mother by surprise. Her face went slack, her eyes wavered. It suddenly dawned on me her greatest fear. "Is that what you're worried about?" I asked her. "That I'll end up like Gramps?" She shook her head quickly. "You're already much better educated than your grandfather," she said. But the certainty had finally drained from her voice. Instead of pushing the point, I stood up and left the room. My mother's worst fears didn't come to pass. I graduated without mishap, was accepted into several respectable schools, and settled on Occidental College in Los Angeles, mainly because I'd met a girl from Brentwood while she was vacationing in Hawaii with her family. But I was still just going through the motions, as indifferent toward college as almost everything else. In sunny Los Angeles, as you strolled through Occidental's campus, a few miles from Pasadena, tree-lined and Spanish-tiled, the students were friendly, the teachers encouraging. In the fall of 1979, Carter, gas lines, and breastfeeding were all on their way out. Reagan was on his way in, mourning in America. When you left campus, you drove on the freeway to Venice Beach or over to Westwood, passing East LA or South Central without even knowing it, just more palm trees peeking out like dandelions over the high concrete walls. LA wasn't all that different from Hawaii, not the part you saw, just bigger and easier to find a barber who knew how to cut your hair. Anyway, most of the other black students at Oxy didn't seem all that worried about compromise. There were enough of us on campus to constitute a tribe, and when it came to hanging out, many of us chose to function like a tribe, staying close together, traveling in packs. Freshman year, when I was still living in the dorms, there'd be the same sort of bull sessions that I'd had with Ray and other blacks back in Hawaii, the same grumblings, the same list of complaints. Otherwise, our worries seemed indistinguishable from those of the white kids around us. Surviving classes, finding a well-paying gig after graduation, trying to get laid. I'd stumbled upon one of the well-kept secrets about black people, that most of us weren't interested in revolt, that most of us were tired of thinking about race all the time, that if we preferred to keep to ourselves, it was mainly because it was the easiest way to stop thinking about it. Easier than spending all your time mad or trying to guess whatever it was that white folks were thinking about you. So why couldn't I let it go? I don't know. I didn't have the luxury, I suppose, the certainty of the tribe. Grow up in Compton and survival becomes a revolutionary act. You get to college and your family is still back there rooting for you. They're happy to see you escape. There's no question of betrayal. But I hadn't grown up in Compton or Watts. I had nothing to escape from except my own inner doubt. I was more like the black students who'd grown up in the suburbs, kids whose parents had already paid the price of escape. You could spot them right away, by the way they talked, the people they sat with in the cafeteria. When pressed, they would sputter and explain that they refused to be categorized, They weren't defined by the color of their skin, they would tell you. They were individuals. To avoid being mistaken for such a sellout, I chose my friends carefully. The more politically active black students, the foreign students, the Chicanos, the Marxist professors and structural feminists and punk rock performance poets. We smoked cigarettes and wore leather jackets. At night in the dorms, we discussed neocolonialism, Frantz Fanon, Eurocentrism, and patriarchy. When we ground out our cigarettes in the hallway carpet or set our stereos so loud that the walls began to shake, we were resisting bourgeois society's stifling constraints. We weren't indifferent or careless or insecure. We were alienated. Ironically, it was black friends, like Regina, that made me rethink such conceits. Even the first time we met, the day she walked into the coffee shop and found a brother named Marcus giving me grief about my choice of reading material. Marcus had waved Regina over to our table, rising slightly to pull out a chair. "Sister Regina," Marcus said, "you know Barack, don't you? I'm trying to tell Brother Barack here about this racist tract he's reading." Marcus held up a copy of Heart of Darkness, Evidence for the Court. I reached over to snatch it out of his hands. "Man, stop waving this thing around," I said. "See there?" Marcus said. "Makes you embarrassed, don't it? Just being seen with a book like this. I'm telling you, man, this stuff will poison your mind." He looked at his watch. "Damn, I'm late for class." He leaned over and pecked Regina on the cheek. "Talk to this brother, will you? I think he can still be saved." Regina smiled and shook her head as we watched Marcus stride out the door. Marcus is in one of his preaching moods, I see. I tossed the book into my backpack. "Actually, he's right," I said. "It is a racist book. The way Conrad sees it, Africa's the cesspool of the world, black folks are savages, and any contact with them breeds infection." Regina blew on her coffee. "So why are you reading it?" "Because it's assigned." I paused, not sure if I should go on. "And because the book teaches me things," I said. "About white people, I mean. See, the book's not really about Africa or black people. It's about the man who wrote it. The European, the American, a particular way of looking at the world. If you can keep your distance, it's all there in what's said and what's left unsaid. So I read the book to help me understand what it is that makes white people so afraid. Their demons. The way ideas get twisted around. It helps me understand how people learn to hate." "And that's important to you," Regina said. "My life depends on it," I thought to myself. But I didn't tell Regina that. I just smiled and said, "That's the only way to cure an illness, right? Diagnose it." Regina smiled back and sipped her coffee. I'd seen her around before, usually sitting in the library with a book in hand, a big, dark woman who wore stockings and dresses that looked homemade, along with tinted, oversized glasses and a scarf always covering her head. I knew she was a junior, helped organize black student events, didn't go out much. She stirred her coffee idly and asked, "What did Marcus call you just now? Some African name, wasn't it?" "Barack." "I thought your name was Barry." "Barack's my given name, my father's name. He was Kenyan." "Does it mean something?" "It means blessed, in Arabic. My grandfather was a Muslim." Regina repeated the name to herself, testing out the sound. "Barack. It's beautiful." She leaned forward across the table. "So why does everybody call you Barry?" "Habit, I guess. My father used it when he arrived in the States. I don't know whether that was his idea or somebody else's. He probably used Barry because it was easier to pronounce. You know, helped him fit in. Then it got passed on to me, so I could fit in." "Do you mind if I call you Barack?" Regina asked. I smiled. "Not as long as you say it right." She tilted her head impatiently, her mouth set in mock offense, her eyes ready to surrender to laughter. We ended up spending the afternoon together, talking and drinking coffee. Regina told me about her childhood in Chicago, the absent father and struggling mother, the Southside sixth flat that never seemed warm enough in winter and got so hot in summer that people went out by the lake to sleep. She told me about the neighbors on her block, about walking past the taverns and pool halls on the way to church on Sunday. She told me about evenings in the kitchen with uncles and cousins and grandparents, the stew of voices bubbling up in laughter. Her voice evoked a vision of black life and all its possibility, a vision that filled me with longing. a longing for place, and a fixed and definite history. As we were getting up to leave, I told Regina I envied her. "For what?" she asked. "I don't know. For your memories, I suppose." Regina looked at me and started to laugh, a round, full sound from deep in her belly. "What's so funny?" I asked. "Oh, Barack," she said, catching her breath. "Isn't life something? And here I was all this time wishing I'd grown up in Hawaii." Strange how a single conversation can change you. Or maybe it only seems that way in retrospect. A year passes and you know you feel differently, but you're not sure what or why or how, so your mind casts back for something that might give that difference shape. A word, a glance, a touch. I know that after what seemed like a long absence, I had felt my voice returning to me that afternoon with Regina. It remained shaky afterward, subject to distortion. But entering my sophomore year, I could feel it growing stronger, sturdier, that constant, honest portion of myself, a bridge between my future and my past.